Okay, I think that's close enough. So welcome everybody to the third day, or something around that, of the meditation retreat. And always, when we get to a Monday morning, just to create some happiness and inspiration for you, just think what all your friends are doing back in Singapore, Indonesia today, stuck in the traffic, trying to get parking spaces, trying to get ready to meet their boss in a few minutes' time. Oh, poor things. Where you are free. The only traffic you had is queuing up for the breakfast. And your boss is not that demanding, I hope. So, it's a wonderful to enjoy the fact that you're on retreat, a nice peaceful place. And so far today at this retreat, just talked about just learning how to prepare the mind and the body by learning how to relax the body, learning how to relax the mind, looking at your peaceometer, and learning how to, what caused it to go down to really relaxed. Because once you are relaxed and comfortable, once you are happy in this moment, then there's no real need to go wandering anywhere else. Sometimes you think you are in Jhana Grove, do you want to be somewhere else? Would you like to go back to Singapore today? Would you like to go do some work today? Would you like me to call your boss, email your boss and see if he's got any work for you? No. So sometimes when we're happy to be here, we don't want to go anywhere else, which is the antidote to restlessness. One of the biggest problems for people meditating is that, yeah, they know what to do, but they sit down, they can watch a breath or look at a piezometer, and after a few minutes, thinking. Thinking all the time. And they can't stop thinking. And sometimes you ask yourself why. And of course, this is the heart of our Buddhist practice. We don't just use force, you use wisdom power. So if you're restless, why are you restless? You know that many of the stuff you have to think about, you don't really need to think about it. Even if you're managing the retreat, it doesn't really matter. You know, trying to plan this and trying to arrange that. Because you do find, I found this a long time ago, that if I plan for the future, then it just, oh, you really mess up the present moment. And you get one plan already, and then there's another problem you have to fix, and another problem you have to fix. There's no end of problems to fix. But then if I don't plan for the future, then I'm irresponsible and things go wrong. But what I did discover, that whether I plan for the future or I just let the future unfold by itself, either way, things go wrong. So they're going to go wrong anyway, so why not enjoy yourself before it goes wrong? And actually it goes wrong less. So that sometimes that I look at it, but still that doesn't stop me thinking. And still, I started to wonder, well, you know, why is it, it's nothing really important I'm thinking about. Sometimes I was just thinking for the sake of thinking. Have you got enough problems in your life already? And then people go and watch these soap operas from Korea. Just to make themselves more irritated. Why do people do that? And it obviously is people like to have something to do. They're obsessed with doing stuff, with thinking, with worrying. And if they If they haven't got their own problems in their own family, they're going to make some problems with somebody else's family. Have you ever noticed that people like drama? If it's their own or somebody else's or on the TV or somewhere. So I started to consider, why is that the case? Why are people not able just to rest when there's nothing to do, when there's nowhere to go, peaceful, comfortable? Why is it that people want to keep creating problems when there's no real problems there? A lot of times it's because we're afraid of the present moment. There's a really deep meaning behind that. It's because when you do something, you exist. You are. When you do nothing, you disappear, and it's just you're not there anymore. Which is where we start to understand where the idea of non-self is actually part of the meditation path. The path is, this is in the Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. I love that little statement. There's a path. But if you travel it, if you meditate, if you walk the path, if you do it, the path vanishes. If you just let go and disappear, the path becomes as wide as an 8-lane superhighway. I said 8-lane because, again, in Chinese culture, 8 is a very good number. You ever know that's why there's the Eightfold Path? You didn't notice that? So anyway, that way that we can understand that there is a sense of discomfort when we don't do anything. Because we're always told that our whole life, if you want to achieve something, then do it. Strive, put forth effort. And here, in meditation, we're going against that stream. Which is weird. So let me explain it again. Somebody already mentioned, I think in an interview or somewhere, about they really like the simile of the coffee shop. And the coffee shop simile goes like this. You, when you go back to, you know, your home city, then, you know, you've got a telephone call, a message. Are you free this afternoon? And it's one of your sort of friends. And you say, yeah, I'm free this afternoon. And they say, great. Can you come out for a cup of coffee? And it's Gloria Jean's. Not the coffee you like, but the coffee I like. And I want to go and have a latte. I know you say that it's just too much milk and it's bad for your health, but I like lattes and you should try one as well. And the chocolate chip muffins are to die for. And I want to sit in the back, not the front where you like to sit. And I want to talk about politics. None of that silly Buddhism and spirituality business. The real stuff. You know, about Mr. Trump and Mr. Kim and what's happening with the economy and Brexit and all this. This is important stuff, so I want to talk about that. We'll sit in the back, we'll sit for 1 hour, and after 1 hour, then, well, I've got to go. And if somebody invites you out, telling you where you have to go, what you have to drink, what you're going to talk about, where you're going to sit, and for how long, honestly, would you like to go out with a person like that? They're called like control freak. So you'd make some excuse, and in my simile, you make the excuse, oh, I just remembered I've got a dentist appointment this afternoon. I'm sorry, maybe next time. And then, to keep your precepts, as soon as you hang up, you ring up your dentist to make an appointment. And just after you made an appointment, you get another phone call from another friend. You know, how you feel this afternoon? Oh, I just got a dentist appointment. Oh, such a shame. I remember that coffee shop just round the back of Singapore somewhere. Because I always remember this coffee shop I went to once. And I'd never know where it is. I'd never find it again. But what happened was one of the first times I went to Singapore, they put me up in Wat Ananda Temple. And in the morning, all the monks, they went off to some dharma, and I was there really hungry. And just, I was hanging around there, and there's one of the members, he was a big supporter of Awatanon, but also a member of the BF. And he saw me, he said, "Oh, no one looking after you?" He said, "I'll take you out for a cup of coffee." And this is, you know, a very small shop, not a franchise, a small shop in some back street, and there's some delicious, a huge queue, but a delicious coffee. I thought, wow, this is really nice. But of course, don't know where it was. There are those shops somewhere, you find them, and you don't tell anybody, because otherwise you won't be able to get a seat at the table anymore. But anyway, so imagine that your friend says, "Hey, you know, do you want, you know, come out for a cup of coffee? That shop, I found where it is, really delicious coffee." And you think, "Oh, I made an appointment for the dentist." And you say, "But, you know, and also that they make the most amazing, like the toast. You know the toast they have in those coffee shops? Kaya toast, yeah. Kaya toast. And it's delicious, the best in the whole Singapore. And, you know, that, you know, I've reserved a table. I know you always like to sit in the front. So I reserved, you know, seats in the front for us. And, you know, you've always wanted to talk about, you know, Buddhism and meditation. You know, just, you know, I've never been interested in that, but, you know, it's getting popular and it makes you just a nice person. I'd love to actually spend time and talk about, you know, meditation and some Buddhism and stuff. And I want to talk about what you want to talk about. I want to try the coffee you like. I want to try the food you like. And what do you do?" And he said, "I'm coming. I'm cancelling my appointment." And then you go and sit there. There's no time limit. You sit there for 3-4 hours. And the reason is because you're sitting with a friend. A friend who's interested in trying what you like to drink, what you like to eat, talking about what interests you. And people like that you spend hours with. Now the simile is your mind and you. "Come on, mind, we're going to meditate now. And you're going to watch the breath. You're not going to do Ajahn Brahm's silly business of just peaceometers. Oh, come on, where does that say peaceometer in the suttas? And you're going to sit for 50 minutes, okay? I'm going to get the timer out, 50 minutes, nothing less, nothing more. And you're going to just watch your breath, no matter what." Would you like to live with a mind like that? Or with a person with a control figure, like always telling you what to do? So what happens is, when you meditate, you know, your sort of mind says, "Oh, here she comes again. I'm getting out of here. What am I going to think about? Come on, I'm going to think about something. Something important." Because restlessness is a sign that your mind is running away from you. Your relationship with yourself is just needs a bit of mending. Which is one of the reasons why. If you say to your mind, "Okay, mind, if you want to be restless, fine, it's okay by me, off you go." Then you find you change the relationship you have with your own mind. You become friends. And you end up sitting here having a great time together, missing lunch because you're having a great time with your best friend. You and your mind. Chilling out together. So, don't be a control freak of your mind. None of that thinking. No past. I caught you last time. You're in the past. In the present. Come on now. No future. Present moment. Silent. Be silent. Silent. Now, what's the breath? Long breath. Short breath. As Ajahn Brahm said yesterday, just watch all the moments. Come on, I'm watching you, watching the breath. That type of control freak mind, that your mind will just run away at the first opportunity. This is not the way to meditate. But if you're with a really, 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 really good friend, you do like hanging out. I remember on this one occasion when I was visiting UK, just I met one of my old friends from university. And his nickname was Flash. And his first name was Harold. I won't say what his second name is. But we called him Flash because after one party in Emmanuel College, Cambridge, He was so drunk that he went to the toilet and he came out leaving his trousers inside. And all the girls were laughing at him. So from that time on, just one mistake, he was known as Flash. And of course now, he was, I think, the top actuary. You know, that's like an accountant, people who do the insurance stuff. Huge salary, very, very well-respected gentleman. And he said, as a bum, you know, Pete was my name. And I said, don't say that. But, you know, he just wouldn't say that. I really have said it in public. But, you know, I don't say who he is. But anyway, what happened was that we were, you know, just started talking. And we couldn't stop. About 3 or 4 hours. The only reason I had to stop was I went to the Wimbledon Temple to give a talk. And I had to go talk to somebody else. If it wasn't for that talk, we'd be still talking. Just the friendship, which is so close. You just talk. And that just was an example of, if you are friends to your mind, you just hang out together. Best friend, you just like each other's company. Now that's how the mind doesn't want to run away from you. It stays with you. So when you close your eyes, you can do just, you know, get your relaxation going, sweep in the body, make sure everything is okay. If you've got some sort of sickness, some tension, somewhere to stay more time with the body, it's really helpful. And then you go to your mind, get it nice and peaceful. And then, okay, now mind, what do you want to do? And you'll find, if you ask your mind what it wants to do, you're not forcing it. A lot of times it said, okay, let's just be here. And what happens when you just being here is that because you're not moving or doing much, some interesting things occur. And this was the anecdotes when I, young man, Buddhist, there's not many places you can go to do a meditation retreat. So any place which was holding a meditation retreat, any tradition, I'd go there. So I signed up for a retreat at a Zen monastery in the north of England. And, you know, it's a typical Zen monastery. The teacher came with a stick in the morning. And if you saw anybody nodding, you tap him on the shoulder, or her on the shoulder, and then whack! I never got hit. I never. It wasn't I wasn't sleepy, but the person sitting next to me was more sleepy. He got hit first, and after he got hit, I was totally straight. I was so afraid. It was the fear that made me awake. So anyway, but now later on, you know, during the day, you're doing a meditation, and in that tradition, you'd meditate with your eyes open, not with your eyes closed, eyes open. And I didn't know why, but there's one thing I was always obedient enough to be like inquisitive. You know, what is this? Why is this? So I'd follow the instructions, and we were asked to keep our eyes open, meditating, and just watching a whitewashed wall. It was in an old converted barn. And so, you know, we'd sit there just watching a white wall. That was all the instructions. No other instructions, just sit there and just watch the wall. And I didn't know what to do, but I'd give anything a try. And I'm sitting there watching the wall. Because I'd meditated before, I knew how to be peaceful, let go of the past and the future, not think. Just watching there, not thinking, watching a wall. And then the wall vanished. And that was really cool. You know, because sometimes it's really boring when nothing happens. You sit here watching the wall, what's going to happen next? Oh, come on. That's when you start fantasizing or start dreaming or thinking, just to fill in the time. But I was just silent, peaceful, just watching the wall. And then it wasn't there anymore. It wasn't blackness, or there was the sight had turned off. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. The wall vanishing. Now, some people would be scared. Would be sort of frightened. Ah, what's going on? But, and I was willing to give anything a sort of exploration. And of course, you use your science. It reminded me that sometimes when you hear sounds, the hum of the background noise, after a while you can't hear it. In the morning we have the aircon on. After a while you can't hear the aircon because it's background noise. You have, please excuse me for this, that you have the feeling of the saliva in your throat. Can you feel it now? Now it's a problem. Before it was no problem whatsoever. Now it's going to take a minute or two before it disappears. But most of the time it's always there, so you don't notice it. It is the nature of the human mind. And the brain, it only notices things which change. If something remains stable, doesn't move, it disappears. These days, you know, you give a simile of your computer screen. If you don't click a mouse, first of all it goes to screen save, and then it just turns off. Disappears. The brain is like that, it's very efficient. It's only got so much gigabytes between the ears, so that it saves it to only notice things which alter and change. Things which remain the same disappear. So, when I was watching that wall, because I wasn't thinking, I was just in the moment, paying attention, the wall vanished. One of my senses turned off. And then, that opened up a huge insights into what this meditation is. Turning off the senses. Especially the five senses. So, eyes closed. Have you ever noticed? You don't need to watch a whitewashed wall. When you close your eyes now, you can see the inside of the eyelids. After a while, because nothing changes there, it's not interesting. After a while, the sense of sight will just turn off. You're not looking at anything. You can open your eyes now. You won't be able to see anything. There is no sight there. It's turned off. Smell. Taste. That turns off after a while. So the two difficult senses to shut down is the sense of physical touch and sound. Physical touch, that's why we've got to, it's one of the reasons why I really emphasize relaxing the body, first of all, when you meditate. Being aware of it, relaxing it, making sure it's nice and comfortable, because then it's easy for the sense of body to disappear. In the same way that when you go to sleep at night, your body has to disappear. If you've got an ache, a toothache, or a leg ache, or something, of course it's hard to get to sleep. It disturbs you. So we try and relax our body. But there is one part of the body which is hard to relax. The breathing. Because if that stops, you're in big trouble. Not really big trouble, but trouble. But when I first came to Perth, that was when the first sensory deprivation chamber was introduced to Western Australia. You know, Sydney's, sometimes they have it in wellness centres and stuff, these little chambers. And the water is salt water, exactly the same density as a human body, so you float. You don't sink. And it's the temperature you like. So if I had one of those flotation chambers, it might would be much colder than yours, but if it was Singapore temperature, you'd be able to float in there and you wouldn't even feel the water because it's your temperature of your body. And there was no pressure anywhere on your body. All just like floating in this warm, supportive water. And when they close the lid, it's total dark. It's no light at all, so there is no sense of sight. It's soundproof, so you can't hear anything from outside. And obviously they must have some ventilation somewhere. But you can't, don't smell, you don't taste, you don't see, you don't hear. And the bodily sensation, it's floating, there's no pressure on anywhere. So what happened? The guy who brought one of those in came to our little temple and said, I've got a flotation chamber, great for meditation, would you like to try it? And I was with another monk, and he said, yeah, we'd love to try those. And man, it's really interesting to get into meditation really quickly. So the other monk who was with me, he was senior, so he got in there first. And I was got my appointment to go in there the next day. Unfortunately, that night, or that following morning, before I could go to the place to get my appointment, you know, to, in the flotation chamber, there was a big advertisement in the local paper, flotation chambers, $100 an hour, as used by Buddhist monks. We've been scammed. The only reason he wanted us to go in there is so he could advertise as used by Buddhist monks. And so I didn't get to go. I said, well, I said, the damage is already done. We can't undo that. Come on, I want to go. No. Oh, really unfair. But anyway, I asked him, what was it like? And he said, well, it's true, you can't see anything. You know, you can't sort of hear any sound outside. You're just floating there. Just no aches or pains on the body at all. Like you'll meditate there for hours. You don't get stiff knee or anything. It's not cold. It's not hot. You don't need blankets. It's just the right temperature. So, well, you know, did you get into jhana or anything? So, well, actually what happened was that all the other sounds were disappeared except one. He said his breathing was just so loud because everything else had disappeared. That was what was prominent, the last thing which was left, his breathing. And then, of course, those little experiences, now I know why the Buddha taught breath meditation. It's not something you do, it's something which happens. Whether you want it, plan it or not. When you're sitting here, you're comfortable, and you just mind gets pretty still, by which you're comfortable staying here, you're not really that interested in the past and the future. And I said, most of the past and the future is none of your business. You only go there just something to do, and escape because you don't know how to be in the present moment. But when you are in the present moment, because you are still, the only thing left moving is your breath. So whether you go looking for your breath or you don't go looking for your breath, the breath comes up anyway. And that's by far the most beautiful way to approach breath meditation. The point that these days I never go looking for my breath. I just sit here nice and peaceful, relaxing my body, relaxing my mind, just being here. And when it's ready, everything else has vanished, and so I'm just going to be aware of my breath, breathing in, breathing out. It's the last thing which I know. Everything else is gone. No thinking of the past, no thinking of the future. Even the noise, the sound is another thing which is difficult to do, to allow to fade away. But it does after a while. You know what happens? Yeah, it's people come in and out of the room, somebody coughs or whatever, but yeah, it's none of your business. When it's none of your business, you know, you don't listen for sounds outside. And sometimes that people, you just maybe in your room, in your cottage, and some people are walking past and they're talking. You start to think, are they talking about me? They're not talking about you, you're not that important. Sorry to say. But people always think, what are they saying? What are they talking about? It's amazing just how our mind just goes out to listen to things which are none of our business. So instead, we just, oh, just sounds outside, people talk, kookaburras laugh, dogs go woof woof, Ajahn Brahm tells stupid jokes, that's the nature of the world, so we just, you know, leave those sounds alone. In other words, we don't disturb the noise. But if you do have noise, and you do need some way of dealing with the noise of someone in your cottage who's a snorer, because you only have a few hours to sleep at night, and if you're unlucky enough to be got a room next to a snorer, even though there's a wall between you and the snorer, my goodness, some of those snorers, you can hear them throughout the whole of, some of them you can hear over in Bodhinyana from here. That is a bit of an exaggeration, but I think you know what I mean. So I know people have asked me, Ajahn Brahm, can you please, you know, we can get a list of notorious snorers, and we can put them all in the same cottage, so that everyone else can have a peaceful time here. But then, people who say that, they usually find out that they're one of the notorious snorers themselves. But anyway, so what do we do with snorers? How do we deal with, like, the disturbance of sound? And again, that was great Ajahn Chah, some of those one-liners which he said, you know, it just changed a lot of the way he looked at life. It's not the noise disturbs you. It's you who disturb the noise. Interesting, isn't it? It's not the cold which disturbs you. Sniffing. It's you who disturb the sniff. What does that mean? And what it meant was that monk, the story of the monk whose brother came to visit Bodhinyana Monastery, and he came to see me, can he, there's no place to stay, it's all full up. But can he stay in my little room, in my, call it kuti, the monk's rooms? He said, well, it's a really small room, it's usually 3 meters by 2.4, it's not that big. He said, but no, he's my brother, we grew up together. So it's only for a couple of nights, we can sleep in the same room. And I said, yeah, but how old are you? He's in his 50s. He said, I'm sure that you snore and your brother snores as well. Because you know sometimes that, you know, we don't know that we snore. Because we're asleep when it happens, so we don't really know. One of the other anecdotes, I've got flipping through anecdotes. I used to go and teach in prison, in jail. In one of these prisons in Australia, high security, some really bad sort of criminals in there, done some really nasty things. So they had to have a prison officer with me at all times. So when I started teaching meditation, you know, the prison officer, you know, he's sitting there, nothing to do, he decided to have a go himself. And then I was meditating there and I heard somebody snoring. It was a prison officer. He's supposed to be guarding everybody and he was fast asleep. And it was really just such good timing. I opened my eyes because one of the other prisoners already had his hands about an inch from the keys of the prison officer. And I had my eyes and he opened his eyes. We looked at each other. And out of respect, he took his hand away so that he didn't take the keys. Otherwise, I'd have been in trouble. But so he's fast asleep, the prison officer. But anyway, so this monk, then we're going to snore. He said, oh, that's okay. I've got a plan. My plan is to go to sleep first. So if I get to sleep first, you don't hear other people in your room. That was his plan. Of course, it never worked. His brother went to sleep first. And really snoring very loud. Really loud. He thought, oh, crikey, I'm not going to be able to get to sleep tonight. So, you know, he was laying there just wondering what to do. His brother was snoring really loudly and he was in the same room. And that's when he remembered Ajahn Chah's teaching. It's not the noise that serves you, it's you who disturb the noise. So what do you mean by that? Stop disturbing my brother snoring. So then he started to change his perception of snoring, to make it not disturbing. He used his powers of imagination to imagine the snoring to be like some modern experimental musical composition which broke the stereotypes of what music is supposed to be. So have like a rhythm which had no connection with what went past, which was all over the place, but which was a statement of rebellion against musical conventions. And it worked. After a while, it actually sounded quite melodious. And that's the last thing you remembered when you woke up in the morning, having a good night's sleep. He changed his perception about snoring from something which was an irritation, which was actually quite interesting. Now that is what the Buddha, Ajahn Chah meant, don't disturb the noise. Not the noise disturbs you, you disturb it by adding this negativity to it. Add positivity to it, and it's just really interesting, very nice, good, melodious snoring. And you just wait for the next crescendo. Anyway, so that is how you settle sound down. But anyway, when you get to the breathing, everything else is settled down and all you've got left is the breath. So a lot of time, if you are meditating, not doing anything but just being in this moment, not trying to see where you're going to get to next, not lingering in the past, present moment awareness, the place where the future is being made. Just being here, being kind in this moment. Then you find that the body relaxes. Oh, first of all, how we let go of the past and the future. One interesting way, I've always mentioned kindness. And now opening the door of your heart to this moment. But also learning how to be kind to the past. Giving metta to the past. Opening the door of your heart to whatever's happened to you in the past. And all the characters in the play which is your life so far. Being kind to everybody. They hurt me. But they thought it may have been a good thing at the time. Maybe they were between a rock and a hard place, as they say. They had a reason for that, I don't know why. But when you're kind to the past and kind to your own contribution to the past, what happens is you soften your attitude to the past. You give yourself and the various actors, you know, in your saga of the past, you give them this benefit of the doubt. They're not just automatically guilty. You're not automatically guilty. Why you did that, I don't know, but it was the best thing you could have done at the time. Maybe you made a mistake, maybe you're tired, maybe you just took a chance and it didn't work out. I remember, again, always have to tell personal anecdotes because they're the ones which you can remember so clearly. You know, you may not realize that when I was young I had long hair and a motorbike. I remember just, I could drive the motorbike okay, but just one day I was going from Notting Hill down into Shepherd's Bush. It was called Notting Hill because it was a hill, it was quite a steep road. And it was a rainy day and somebody stepped out onto a pedestrian crossing. And the car in front of me slammed on its brakes. And I was behind the car, the right distance, not travelling over the speed limit, slammed on my brakes as well and got into a skid. so the bike was out of control, heading for the rear of a car. And I had this split-second decision to slam into the back of the car and don't know what injuries I would sustain. Or I had enough control to swerve around the car, but you know, couldn't sort of stop before the pedestrian crossing. And who knows, maybe slam into a person and injure them. And it was one of those split-second decisions, what should you do? And of course, you know, the decision I made was to swerve around the car because I knew it was 100% I'd really get injured if I went into the back of the car. But if I swerved around, I didn't know where that pedestrian was. Maybe I would miss him. And I did miss him. And afterwards, I just parked my bike and just started sweating and shaking. Because, you know, it was one of those decisions that could have put me in jail, injured, or it worked out okay for me. That's what life is like sometimes. Split-second decisions, it could be quite easy that I could have done a lot of damage. But, you know, good luck. That's all. So sometimes it's very hard to criticize others who make a decision like that and it doesn't work out for them. So anyway, that's why it's so hard. It doesn't make sense anymore to me to actually to hold anger from the past, to make judgments, to criticize. That's why on the kitchen there, because I went in there looking for Eileen this morning to get the USB for the Word of the Buddha. And then there was that old poem in there which I put on, opening the door of your heart. One of the lines is, learn to be kind and you will realize your judgment of others was too severe. Beautiful line. When you are kind, you know, you realize you judged others too harshly. Why they did that, I don't know, but they had their reasons. Why you did that, the mistakes you've made in your life, don't be harsh on yourself. Because, you know, these things happen in life. So when you're kind to the past, it softens the past, and then the past is easier to let go. When it's really hard and heavy, it's really hard to let it go. It sort of kind of sticks to you. But then when you soften it with kindness, really soften it with more and more kindness, and oh, I don't know why I did that, I don't know why that person did that, you soften and soften and soften it, and it makes it much easier to let go. The same with the future. You know, you have metta towards the future. Sometimes people say, can I have metta towards beings? Yeah, I can have loving kindness towards, like, my cat. I can have loving kindness towards the little birds flying through the branches of the trees. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Actually, tweet is not a good word anymore since Mr. Trump started tweeting. The birds must be very embarrassed. And, but when you're kind not just to animals, you're kind to things. That wonderful story. It's amazing how you can be kind to machines. And they work. I tried that quite a few times. Now personally, I was in Oslo. And this was, and picked me up from the airport. And one of the machines, you know, you pay the money or my driver paid the money for the parking. You know, but the boom would not go up. And there was a number of people there waiting. There was a big queue waiting. Because, you know, it wasn't working, it was stuck or something. So, of course, I came along. May all booms be happy and well. It lifted up. Really impressive. But the best one. Oh, there's... I haven't seen this guy for a while, but when I saw him, I really interrogated. Are you sure this was true? Have I got all the details right? Did it work? You know, so don't lie to me. If it didn't work, fine. Just, but did it really work? I said, yeah, it did. This is what happened. He was an Anagarika for 1 year at Bodhinyana, then he went to Germany to do a degree at university in Frankfurt. And then the first day on campus, he was having his lunch, he walked past the ATM, the automatic teller machine. And he said, that automatic teller machine, it made a gurgling noise. And he interpreted that, having hung around a crazy monk for a year, he interpreted that as the ATM was talking to him, welcoming into campus. So he wished the ATM all happiness and well-being. He gave it metta. May your euros never run out. May no one ever hit you and swear at you because they found that their current account balance is zero and they can't get any money out. May credit cards never be chewed up inside because, you know, they're over the limit. May you always be happy and well. And may you never run out of electricity. And he was kind like that to the ATM. And he said, well, one day he was sitting there in the sunshine having his lunch, you know, just really close to the ATM. No one had been near it for about 10 or 15 minutes. And then the ATM made the gurgling sound again. The second time he'd heard it, when he came on campus and now again. And he looked around at his friend, the ATM, and a 20 euro note came out, all by itself. No one had pressed any buttons, no credit card had gone in there, no one had been close to it, and he couldn't believe it. But, you know, he was a student, he didn't have much money, so 20 euros is quite a bit of money. So he took the 20 euro note out and he waved it around. He said, does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it, so he put it in his pocket and said, thank you. To the ATM. Weird story, but I believe that. And he swears it was true. So, if you ever fall on hard times in Singapore or in Jakarta, go to an ATM. ATM, may all ATMs be happy and well. May you never run out of cash. May you all never be stolen and ripped out of the wall by these thieves. May you be wonderful and happy and joyful. Now, $26, please. But if you can do that to an ATM, you can do that to a boom gate. You can do that. I did that. Used to do that to my cement mixer. I had a cement mixer here in many of the buildings I've built myself. My cement mixer, sometimes other people, they couldn't get it to work. I always could. I was always kind to it. I treated it like a being. You know, cement mixer, come on. We got to lay some bricks to build a nice place for the ladies' quarters. Pulled the string, it worked first time. It's amazing. I don't know if you've ever had those experiences. Machines. You're kind to them and it works. So anyway, so you can also be kind to the future. May my future be happy and well. And treat it like a being. Like this incredible uncertain future. And just be soft and kind to it. Yeah, I've got my biopsy coming in next week. Oh! May my biopsy be happy and well. May I've got my seeing my boss next week when I go back. May my boss be happy and well. May my promotion and increase in salary be happy and well. May my mother-in-law or my mother be sort of not such a pain in the butt when I come back. May. Whatever it is, you find that it does work when you have loving kindness towards the future. Your future usually becomes much more positive. Which means you can trust it. You don't worry about it. You can let it go. So by being kind to the past and kind to the future, it lets you let it go much more easily. And then you're left with the present moment. So you've got to be kind to the present moment. Hi, present moment, how are you? How can you be kind to the present moment? smile at the present moment. It's working. When I smile at you, you smile back. Come on, don't resist it. Smile. And that gives you a bonding with the present moment, a kindness. But if you frown, did that work? Do I need more practice frowning? But if you frown, you want to go away. So if you've got the present moment, whatever you're experiencing, be kind to it. Hi, breath, how are you? In the bed, hi, Jennifer. Then you stick together, which means you don't have restlessness. So restlessness shows that there's a bad relationship between you and this moment. So be kind to it. Don't be afraid of it. This present moment is here, it's your life, the only time you ever have. This is where nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment, this is all here. All we need to do is just to open up into this present moment. So, we never just, if any of you come and ask a question, I get this stage of meditation, what should I do next? Bang! There is no next. It's what you're doing now, that's the only sort of question. Not forget about the next. The next is an evolution from this present moment. You're kind to this moment, and then the future, being made in this moment, will go out, will go and be beautiful, peaceful, and happy. That's how it works. So when you're kind to the moment, kind to the past, kind to the future, you find that things disappear, and then the breath comes to you. So once you're aware of the breath, then what do? Nothing! Stay with the breath, be with the breath, be kind to the breath. Hi breath, how are you? And you hang out for hours and hours and hours, just being with the breath. What do? Do you plan when you have a cup of coffee with a friend, what you're going to do? For the first 5 minutes I'm going to talk about Buddhism, for the second I'm going to talk about... You don't plan things like that, you just let it flow. You have a wonderful time together. Same with watching, doing the breath meditation. It just, after a while, you get really into the breath. So from the very beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath, you get really into it, just enjoying it. This afternoon we get to the, will we get to that? I don't know. But you get to the point where you start to see the happiness of the breath, the joy. You really enjoy each other's company. Breathing in, breathing out, I can do this. Breathing in, breathing out, And you have a really nice time with your breathing. That's like, sometimes you have a nice time with a friend, chatting, enjoying each other's company, laughing, telling old stories. Having a good time. Having a good time with the breath. It's not work. It's relaxation. It's letting go. So that's what meditation is all about. So anyway, that's just with the breath meditation. And of course, we'll go further tomorrow. But that is enough for today. Sadhu! 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 Okay, got some interviews for those who want interviews.